I've been a paramedic in Chicago for 6 years now. If you've never worked emergency medicine in a major city, let me paint you a picture. It's chaos. Beautiful, terrible chaos. You get used to the overdoses in gas station bathrooms, the car accidents on the Dan Ryan at rush hour, the cardiac arrests in cramped apartments where you're doing compressions while family members scream in your ear. You learn to compartmentalize, to be able to eat your lunch 30 minutes after watching someone die. You learn that most people's worst day is just another Tuesday for you. My partner, Magnus, has been doing this for 15 years. He's seen everything twice over. Gang shootings, house fires, you name it. Magnus is the guy who stays calm when everyone else is losing their minds. He's the guy who can talk down a psych patient having a violent episode or crack a joke dark enough to make you forget the smell of burnt flesh. He's taught me more about this job than any textbook ever could. But here's the thing about Magnus that always struck me as odd. About once a month, we get a call that doesn't make it into our official reports. I noticed the pattern about 2 years in. We'd respond to something, usually weird, usually in a part of the city that feels just slightly off, and Magnus would handle everything. He'd always drive on those calls, wouldn't let me take the wheel, even when it was my turn in the rotation. And afterward, the paperwork would be minimal. A few lines, nothing detailed, nothing that captured what we'd actually seen. And Magnus would never, ever let me ask questions about it afterward. I tried once. We'd responded to a call in an abandoned building where we found a guy who'd been dead for at least 3 days, but the 911 call had come from his phone 10 minutes before we arrived. I started to say something back at the station, and Magnus just looked at me with this expression I'd never seen before. It wasn't angry. Scared. "Let it go," he said. That was it. Let it go. So I did, because Magnus had kept me alive more times than I could count, and if he said let it go, I let it go. One night, Magnus called in sick. In 6 years of working together, I'd never known Magnus to call in sick. The guy came to work with a broken finger, with his marriage falling apart. But that night, at 9:47 p.m, I got a text. "Not feeling great. Taking the night off. Be careful out there." I was partnered with Jake for the shift, a rookie who'd been on the job for maybe 8 months. Nice kid. Eager, but talked too much. We'd handled 2 calls already. First was a drunk college student who'd fallen down some stairs, and an elderly woman with chest pains who turned out to be having a panic attack. It was just after midnight when the dispatcher's voice came over the radio. And I swear to God, I felt my stomach drop before she even finished the sentence. "Medic 47, we have an unresponsive person at 1247 Riverside Avenue, apartment 4F. Police are not on scene. Repeat, no police on scene." It was the tone, flat and emotionless. Jake reached for the radio to confirm, but I grabbed his wrist. He looked at me, confused. "Let me," I said. I picked up the radio. "Dispatch, this is Medic 47. Can you repeat that address?" A pause, longer than it should have been. 1247 Riverside Avenue, apartment 4F. "Copy that. Medic 47 en route." I hung up the radio and started the engine. Jake was staring at me. "You okay? You look like you've seen a ghost." I didn't answer. I was too busy trying to remember if Marcus had ever told me what to do if I got one of those calls without him. He hadn't. I pulled out of the station, and for the first time in 6 years, I understood exactly why Marcus always drove. Because when you're behind the wheel, you can't run. 1247 Riverside Avenue was a mid-rise apartment building in Lakeview. You could tell it had seen better days, but it wasn't quite run down enough to be condemned. Brick facade, probably built in the 70s, with a security door that buzzed open without anyone asking who we were. Jake grabbed the jump bag and monitor while I took the oxygen kit. Standard response. Nothing felt different yet, except for the knot in my stomach that wouldn't go away. The elevator was broken. Of course it was, so we took the stairs to the fourth floor. Jake was talking the whole way up, something about a call he'd run last week. But I wasn't listening. I was trying to focus on the routine, one foot in front of the other. The fourth floor hallway was long and narrow, lit by flickering fluorescent lights that gave everything a sickly yellow tinge. Apartment doors marched down both sides. 4A, 4B, 4C on the left, 4D, 4E, 4G on the right. I stopped. Jake nearly walked into me. What's wrong? Where's 4F? He looked at the doors, then back at me. What do you mean? I pointed. 4E, then 4G. There's no 4F. Jake walked down the hall, checking each door number. That's weird. Maybe it's a typo. Maybe they meant 4E. I pulled out my radio. Dispatch, Medic 47, can you confirm the apartment number? We're showing no apartment 4F at this location. Static. Then, 1247 Riverside Avenue, apartment 4F, fourth floor. Dispatch, there is no apartment 4F. The hallway goes from 4E to 4G. Another pause, longer this time. I could hear keyboard clicking in the background. Medic 47, our system shows apartment 4F, fourth floor. The call came from inside that unit. I looked at Jake. He shrugged, already moving back toward the stairs. Maybe it's on a different wing. These old buildings can be weird. Yeah, I said. Weird. We checked the other side of the hallway. Same thing. No 4F. Jake suggested we try 4E. Maybe the caller got confused. I was about to agree when I decided to walk the hallway one more time just to be sure. 4A, 4B, 4C, 4D, 4E. And there it was. 4F. I stopped so abruptly, Jake walked into me this time. Dude, what? He saw it too. The door was there, brass number screwed into dark wood. 4F. The paint was older than the other doors, more worn. And it was open, slightly ajar, maybe an inch, enough to see darkness inside. That wasn't there before, Jake whispered. I know, Jake. My hand was on my radio. I should call this in. I should tell dispatch that something is very wrong here. But what would I even say? That a door appeared out of nowhere? They'd think I was on something. I thought about Magnus, about the way he looked at me when he said, "Let it go." About his text this morning. Be careful out there. I pushed the door open. The apartment was dark, except for the light spilling in from the hallway. I found a light switch and flipped it. A single overhead bulb flickered on, revealing a small studio apartment. Old furniture, floral wallpaper that might have been pretty in 1982. And on the floor, between a worn couch and a coffee table covered in prescription bottles, was an elderly woman. She was lying motionless on her back, arms at her side, staring at the ceiling. Training took over. I dropped to my knees beside her while Jake set up the monitor. "Ma'am, ma'am, can you hear me?" I checked for a pulse. Her skin was ice cold, no pores. I tilted her head back, checked her airway. "Jake, she's not breathing. Get the bag ready." Jake was already moving, pulling out the ambu bag. I started compressions. Her chest felt rigid under my hands, like she'd been dead for hours. "Medic 47 to dispatch. We have an unresponsive elderly female. No pulse, no respirations. Starting CPR." Her eyes flicked open like a doll's to reveal a milky white. She had no iris, no pupil. It was like the life was drained from them. I froze, hands still on her chest. Jake made a sound I'd never heard another human make, something between a gasp and a whimper. The woman's head turned toward me, smooth and mechanical, and a hand shot out and grabbed my wrist. Her grip was ice cold and strangely strong. Her mouth moved, her voice dry, crackling like old paper. "They're already here," she said. "Why did you come?" I tried to pull away. Her fingers dug into my wrist. "Ma'am, let go. Why did you come?" Jake was backing toward the door, the ambu bag falling from his hands. I yanked my arm hard, and a grip released all at once. I scrambled backward, and the woman's head lolled back to center, eyes still open, still white. And then she just stopped. The monitor, which Jake managed to attach, showed a flat line. A systole. She was dead. Really dead this time. "What the hell?" Jake was saying over and over. "What the hell? What the hell?" I checked her pulse again, just to be sure. Nothing. Skin already cooling. She'd been dead before we started CPR, maybe hours before. I looked at her eyes. They were normal now. Brown, cloudy with death, but normal. "We need to go," I said. "What?" "We need to leave, now." I grabbed the monitor, started packing up. Jake didn't argue. We were out of that apartment in 30 seconds, and I pulled the door shut behind us. In the hallway, I turned back to look. The door to 4F was gone. Just wall and faded wallpaper. Jake saw it too. "Down the stairs," I said. "Don't run. Walk normally. Don't say anything." We made it to the ambulance, just as a black sedan pulled up to the curb, with tinted windows and no plates. It wasn't the police. Two people got out, a man and a woman, both in dark suits that looked expensive. They moved with purpose, neither hurrying nor wasting time. The woman approached me while the man headed into the building. "You responded to the call at 1247 Riverside?" she asked. Her voice was pleasant, professional, like she was asking about the weather. "Yes. What did you find?" I looked at Jake. He was staring at the woman like she was speaking a foreign language. "Apartment 4F, I said. "Elderly woman, unresponsive. We started resuscitation, but she was already..." "Apartment 4E, the woman corrected, smiling. Not a warm smile. A smile that said we were going to agree with her. "You responded to apartment 4E. Elderly woman, deceased on arrival. Natural causes. Likely cardiac arrest. You assessed the patient, confirmed she was beyond resuscitation, and cleared the scene. Standard DOA protocol." She pulled out a tablet, tapped the screen a few times, then turned it toward me. There was a report already filled out, my name at the top. Everything she'd just said was typed neatly into the appropriate fields. "That's what happened," she said. It wasn't a question. I looked at the report, looked at her. She was still smiling. "Sign here," she said, offering me her stylus. My hand was shaking. I could feel Jake staring at me, waiting to see what I'd do. I thought about Magnus again. I took the stylus and signed it. "Excellent," the woman said, taking the tablet back. "You did good work tonight. The family appreciates your professionalism during a difficult time." "What family?" Jake blurted out. The woman looked at him for the first time, really looked at him. Jake went pale. "The family of the deceased," she said slowly, like she was explaining something to a child. "In apartment 4E? You should go back to your station now. I'm sure you have other calls waiting." She walked back to the sedan. The man emerged from the building a moment later, carrying a black bag I hadn't seen him take in. They got in the car and drove away. Jake and I stood there for a long moment, and we drove back to the station in complete silence. Jake kept opening his mouth like he was going to say something, then closing it again. My wrist still hurt where the woman, the dead woman, the woman with white eyes, had grabbed me. I found a bruise there, 5 finger-shaped marks, dark purple against my skin. They didn't fade for 2 weeks. Magnus was at the station when we got back. I saw him through the bay doors as I pulled in, sitting at the table in the common room with a cup of coffee, looking completely fine, like he'd been waiting. Jake practically ran inside, mumbling something about needing to use the bathroom. I heard him lock himself in and turn on the faucet. I walked in. Magnus looked up at me, and I saw it in his eyes immediately. He knew. "You got a Type 7 call, didn't you?" he said quietly. I sat down across from him. "What the hell was that, Magnus?" He glanced toward the hallway, making sure we were alone. "The system flags certain calls, Type 7s. They get routed to experienced crews, people who can handle irregularities." "Irregularities?" "Things that don't fit in normal reports. Heart attacks that aren't medical, accidents that aren't accidental, calls from addresses that shouldn't exist." He leaned forward. "There are things in this city that don't belong in the daylight. Most people never see them. But sometimes, something breaks through. Someone calls 911, and someone has to respond. So they send us. They send paramedics who can handle it, who can see something impossible, do their job anyway, and then let it go." He looked at me hard. "You did good tonight. You signed the report. That's exactly what you're supposed to do." "What happens if I hadn't signed it?" Magnus went very quiet. He stared into his coffee. "Magnus, don't ask questions you don't want answered," he said finally. "Just do the job, file the paperwork, go home to your family." "The people in the suits," I said, "they're the ones who clean it up." "Quality assurance. They handle everything, make sure it doesn't get into the news, doesn't cause panic. They have protocols, procedures, and pre-filed reports." He paused. "They've been doing this for decades, maybe longer." "How many paramedics have worked Type 7s? "Dozens over the years. Most handle it like you did. See something wrong, do their job, sign the paperwork, go home. They get hazard pay and don't ask questions. His jaw tightened. The ones who do ask questions transfer to other departments or take early retirement or have accidents. The way he said accidents made my blood run cold. I've been doing this for 15 years, Magnus continued, stopped counting the type 7s at 100. I was told to call in sick tonight. I hope they'd reassigned your call to someone with more experience, but they sent you anyway. He stood up and put a hand on my shoulder. Because you're good at your job, you stay calm, you can handle it. And you've proved them right. He headed for the door, then stopped. Go home, get some rest. Next shift, we'll be back to normal chaos. Overdoses and car accidents, regular stuff. He looked back at me. Don't upset the balance. Just do your job, sign the paperwork, and go home. Then he was gone. Jake emerged from the bathroom a few minutes later, pale but composed. Are we going to talk about what happened? He asked. I thought about Magnus's warning, about the woman in the suit and her pleasant smile. No, I said, we're not. Jake nodded and left without another word. I sat alone in the common room, staring at the bruises on my wrist. 5 finger-shaped marks, dark purple against my skin. Somewhere in this city, right now, there were things that didn't belong, things that broke the rules of reality. And there was an entire system designed to make sure no one ever knew about them. I was part of that system now, whether I wanted to be or not. A week passed, 7 shifts of normal calls. A stabbing in Englewood, a 3-car pileup on Lakeshore Drive, an elderly man with pneumonia, 2 overdoses, a diabetic emergency. Jake and I didn't talk about the apartment. Magnus acted like nothing had happened. The bruises on my wrist faded to yellow, then disappeared. I almost convinced myself that it would be a one-time thing. Then, on a Tuesday night at 11:34 p.m, the dispatcher's voice came over the radio with that same careful, flat tone. Medic 47, we have multiple casualties at downtown station, Red Line platform, track 3. Fire and police are en route. Magnus was driving. He let out a deep breath, but he didn't say anything, just flipped on the lights and sirens. Multiple casualties, I said. Train derailment? Dispatcher didn't say. They always say. Magnus didn't respond. We arrived before fire or police. The station entrance was still open, and a few late-night commuters were heading down the stairs, completely oblivious. Magnus grabbed the jump bag and trauma kit. I took the monitor and oxygen. We descended into the station. It was surprisingly empty for a Tuesday night. Just a CTA worker at the booth, reading something on his phone. He didn't look up as we passed. The platform was deserted. Fluorescent lights hummed overhead. Somewhere, water dripped. The electric sign said the next train would arrive in 4 minutes. And on the tracks, 5 people were lying motionless. They were arranged almost neatly, parallel to each other, like they'd laid down deliberately. 2 men, 3 women, ranging in age from maybe 20 to 60. Different races, different clothing, nothing connecting them that I could see. Jeez, I muttered, moving toward the edge of the platform. We climbed down onto the tracks. I checked for the sound of an approaching train. Nothing. The tunnel in both directions was dark and silent. I knelt beside the first body, a woman in a business suit. Her eyes were open, staring upward. Her mouth was open too, frozen in what looked like a scream. The expression on her face was pure terror, a look I'd only seen a few times in my career, on people who died violently. No pulse, skin already cooling. "This one's gone," I said, moving to the next. Magnus was checking the others, moving quickly from one body to the next. I heard him mutter something under his breath. "Magnus? They're all dead." He sat back on his heels. "And they've been gone for hours. Rigor mortis is already setting in." I looked at my watch. "Dispatch called this in 10 minutes ago." "I know." I examined the man in front of me more closely. Middle-aged, wearing jeans and a Cubs jacket. No visible injuries, nothing to indicate the cause of death. Just that same expression of absolute terror, mouth open, eyes wide. And then I saw it. On his neck, just below his left ear, a small, circular burn, perfectly round, maybe the size of a dime. The skin was blackened at the center, red around the edges. "Magnus," I pointed, "look at this." I checked the woman in the business suit. Same mark, same location, left side of the neck, just below the ear. "They all have it," I said, moving to the third body. "All of them have the same..." Magnus moved fast, pulling a sheet from the trauma bag and draping it over the nearest body. "Don't look too close." "What? Magnus, this is evidence. We need to document..." "We need to wait for quality assurance." He was covering the other bodies now, his movements quick and efficient. "That's all we need to do." "Five people are dead, Magnus. They have identical marks on their necks. That's not coincidence. That's not our job." He finished, covering the last body and stood up, pulling me back toward the platform. "Our job is to confirm they're deceased and secure the scene. That's it." I heard footsteps on the platform above us, multiple people moving with purpose. 2 CTA supervisors appeared first, both in transit authority uniforms. Behind them, 4 people in suits, 3 men and 1 woman. Not the same woman from the apartment, but she had that same professional, detached expression. "Paramedics," one of the suits said, not quite a question. "What's the situation?" Magnus climbed back onto the platform, pulling me up after him. 5 deceased individuals on the tracks, no visible cause of death, no train involvement. The woman in the suit nodded, like this was exactly what she'd expected to hear. She gestured to the others, and they climbed down onto the tracks, pulling back the sheets Magnus had just placed. One of them had a device I didn't recognize, something that looked like a Geiger counter, but wasn't. He waved it over each body, checking a readout. "Confirmed," he said quietly. "All 5. The woman turned back to us. "Thank you for responding. We'll take it from here." "What about the police?" I asked. "Fire department. This is a crime scene." "There's been a malfunction with the emergency call system," she said smoothly. "A false alarm triggered, multiple dispatch codes. Fire and police have been notified and the response is not needed." "There are 5 dead people." "There are no casualties," she interrupted, still smiling that same professional smile. "You responded to a false alarm at downtown station, equipment malfunction. You found the platform empty. That's what happened." Magnus put a hand on my shoulder, a warning. I looked back at the tracks. The suits were already moving the bodies, working with practiced efficiency. One of them was taking photographs with a camera that had no flash. Another was collecting samples from something on the platform. "Equipment malfunction," the woman repeated. "You can file your report back at the station." We were dismissed. Marcus led me back through the station, past the CTA worker, who still hadn't looked up from his phone, up the stairs to street level. The ambulance was where we'd left it. "Get in," Magnus said. I got in. We drove 3 blocks in silence before I finally spoke. "What killed them?" "I don't know. Magnus, I don't know," he repeated, harder this time. "And I don't want to know. Neither should you." They had burns on their necks, all of them, same location, same size. "I know." "So what does that? What kills 5 people with no visible trauma except a small burn?" Magnus's jaw was tight. "Something we're not equipped to handle. Something that quality assurance will figure out and contain and make sure never happens again." He glanced at me. "That's how this works. We respond, we confirm, we report. They handle the rest. They're covering it up. They're preventing panic. There's a difference." I thought about those faces, that terror. Whatever those 5 people had seen before they died, it had been bad enough to literally freeze the fear on their faces. "How many calls like this have you worked?" I asked. Magnus was quiet for a long time. "Enough to know that asking questions doesn't change anything. It just makes it harder to sleep at night." We got back to the station at 12:47 a.m. There was a report already waiting in my inbox, pre-filled, just like last time. False alarm, equipment malfunction, platform was empty, cleared scene at 12:15. I signed it. But when I got home that morning, I couldn't sleep. I kept seeing those 5 bodies lined up on the tracks, those open mouths, those wide eyes, that perfect circular burn. And I kept thinking, somewhere in this city, something had killed 5 people in a way that left almost no evidence. Something that made experienced paramedics look away and suits with strange equipment show up within minutes. Something that quality assurance wanted to make sure no one ever knew about. I lay in bed, staring at the ceiling, listening to the distant sound of the L train rumbling past. I wondered how many other people had died like that, wondering how many more would. I started looking through old reports during my downtime at the station. Not trying to draw attention, just pulling up calls from the database while Magnus was out on runs or during slow nights when no one was paying attention. The pattern emerged quickly once I knew what I was looking for. Calls with minimal documentation. A few lines, barely any detail, no follow-ups, and no patient transport, just cleared scene or unfounded or referred to other agency. And they were always handled by the same names, veteran paramedics, people who'd been on the job for 10, 15 or 20 years. I started tracking the names. Richards, 14 years on the job, transferred to fire prevention in 2019. Klein, 18 years, early retirement in 2021. Peters, 11 years, transferred to training division in 2020. The pattern was consistent. Worked the job for years, handled dozens or hundreds of these minimal documentation calls, then suddenly leave field work. One name kept appearing more than others. Sophie Wu. She worked as a paramedic for 12 years, from 2009 to 2021. Her name was on over 200 reports with minimal documentation, more than anyone else I'd found. Then, in March 2021, she took early retirement. After that, nothing. Her name just disappeared from the system entirely. I found her obituary on the third page of Google results. Sophie Wu, 38, died in a single vehicle accident on I-290 on June 15, 2021. She is survived by a sister, Michelle Wu of Portland, Oregon. 3 months after early retirement, car accident. I stared at the obituary photo. She looked tired, older than 38. I closed the browser and sat in the quiet station, listening to the hum of the fluorescent lights. How many Type 7 calls had Sophie Wu worked? 200 documented, probably more that weren't in the system. 12 years of responding to things that shouldn't exist, of signing pre-filled reports and not asking questions. And then, she tried to leave. I looked at the clock, 3:42 a.m. Magnus was due back from a call any minute. I cleared my browser history and went back to scrolling through my phone, pretending I'd just been killing time. But I couldn't stop thinking about that photo, about the look in Sophie Wu's eyes. She'd known something, and knowing had gotten her killed. The question was, how much could I learn before I ended up the same way? The call came in at 6:15 p.m., right at shift change. Structural fire, Westmont Towers, 1840 North Clark, 23rd floor, multiple units responding. We could see the smoke from 6 blocks away, dark clouds billowing from the upper floors of a luxury high-rise in Lincoln Park. By the time we arrived, it was a full response. 4 fire trucks, 2 ladder companies, police blocking off the street, and ambulances staged in a line. Chaos. Residents streaming out of the building in their expensive athleisure wear, some carrying pets, others on their phones recording everything. Magnus parked at the staging area. We were the 3rd ambulance on scene. A man in a suit appeared at my window before I could even open the door. "Medic 47," he said. "Yeah? Come with me, side entrance." Magnus and I exchanged a glance. He grabbed a jump bag without a word. The suit led us from the chaos around the corner to a service entrance. A service elevator was waiting, doors open. We got in. The suit pressed 23. "What's the situation?" I asked. "Single occupant, unresponsive, 23rd floor." "What about the fire?" He didn't answer. The elevator rose in silence. I watched the numbers climb. The doors opened on the 23rd floor. No smoke, fire or heat. The hallway was pristine. Cream-colored walls, expensive light fixtures, the faint smell of whatever cleaning product rich people use. The suit led us to apartment 2304. The door was open. Inside, the apartment was immaculate. Floor-to-ceiling windows with a view of the lake, modern furniture, the kind you see in magazines. Everything clean and perfectly arranged. Except for the walls. Scorch marks covered every surface. Not random, but in perfect geometric patterns. Circles within circles, lines intersecting at precise angles, symbols I didn't recognize. The marks were burned into the paint, the drywall beneath blackened and cracked. And in the center of the living room, sitting in a leather armchair facing the windows, was a man. He was maybe 40, wearing a dress shirt and slacks. His hands were on the armrests, his head tilted back slightly. His eyes were open, staring at the ceiling. He wasn't breathing. Magnus moved forward, checking for a pulse. I set up the monitor and attached the leads. Flatline. How long has he been down? I asked the suit. Unknown. I checked the man's skin. Normal temperature, no rigor mortis. He looked like he died minutes ago, not hours. But something was wrong. His expression was blank, completely empty, like someone had erased everything behind his eyes. Magnus pulled out a pen light and checked the man's pupils. Fixed and dilated. I looked around the apartment again. Those geometric patterns burned into every wall, the precision of them. Nothing else was damaged. My eyes landed on the coffee table. The man's phone was there, screen still lit. A text message was open. Don't tell them what you saw. Magnus, I said quietly, look at this. He glanced at the phone, then quickly looked away, but I saw his jaw tighten. What did he see? I asked. Magnus didn't answer. He was checking the man's vitals again, but his hands were shaking. Magnus, what did he... We confirm death and clear the scene, Magnus said, his voice tight. That's all. Footsteps in the hallway. Three more suits entered, along with two people in hazmat gear carrying equipment I didn't recognize. The lead suit, a different one, older, with grey at his temples, looked at us. Status. Male, approximately 40 years old. Deceased, Magnus said. No obvious cause of death. The suit nodded. Gas leak explosion. Single fatality. Standard procedure. He gestured toward the door. We'll take it from here. Gas leak? I said. There's no damage except... Gas leak, the suit repeated, harder this time. You can clear the scene. Magnus was already packing up. I followed him out, glancing back once. The people in hazmat suits were spraying something on the walls. The scorch marks were disappearing, the geometric patterns fading like they'd never existed. Outside, the fire trucks were already leaving. The smoke, or whatever it had been, was gone. Residents were being led back into the building by police officers who were explaining that there'd been a small gas leak on the 23rd floor, quickly contained. No danger, everything was fine. And they believed it. I watched them nod, relieved, already pulling out their phones to text friends and family that everything was okay. We got back in the ambulance. Magnus drove. Three blocks from the scene, he pulled a flask from under his seat and took a long drink. I'd worked with Magnus for 6 years. I'd never seen him drink on shift. Magnus, don't, he said. Just don't. He took another drink, then put the flask away and kept driving. I looked at my hands. They were shaking too. That text message kept playing in my mind. Don't tell them what you saw. Whatever that man had seen, it had killed him. Killed him and burned impossible patterns into his walls. And now, it was like it had never happened at all. I found Magnus in the station locker room at the end of the shift, sitting on the bench with his head in his hands. I need to know what we're dealing with, I said. He didn't look up. No. You don't. Yes, I do. I sat down next to him. That man in the apartment, those five people on the tracks, the woman in 4F. I need to know what's killing them. It doesn't matter what, it matters to me. Magnus finally looked at me. He looked exhausted, older than I'd ever seen him. You think this city runs on laws and logic? He said quietly. Traffic laws and building codes and the natural order of things. He laughed, but there was no humor in it. It doesn't. There are things that live here alongside us. Old things, wrong things, things that don't care about our rules because they operate on different ones. I waited. He was finally talking. Quality assurance isn't a department, he continued. It's a protocol. When reality breaks, when something that shouldn't exist does exist, when the rules stop working, someone has to clean it up, contain it, make sure it doesn't spread. The people in suits. We call them adjusters. They modify records, memories, and sometimes evidence. They make the impossible possible to ignore. He rubbed his face. Paramedics like us, we're the first responders. We show up when reality is still broken, when the scene is still fresh. We confirm what we can, we document what really happened. Not in the official reports, but somewhere. Someone keeps track, and then we let the adjusters bury it. Why? The word came out harder than I intended. Why cover it up? 5 people died on those tracks. That man in the apartment saw something that killed him. Don't they deserve... Deserve what? The truth? Marcus stood up, pacing. Okay, say we tell the truth. Say we put it in the official record. 5 people killed by an unknown entity, geometric burn patterns of unknown origin, an apartment that appears and disappears. What happens then? I didn't answer. I'll tell you what happens. News picks it up, social media explodes, people start asking questions, demanding answers. And when they don't get answers that make sense, they panic. They stop taking the train, they stop going to work, they start seeing threats everywhere, because now they know, really know, that there are things out there that can kill them in ways that they can't understand or prevent. He turned to face me. The city collapses. Not in a bang, but slowly. Fear spreads faster than any disease. Trust in institutions evaporates. And those things out there, those old, wrong things, they feed on that fear. They get stronger, more bold, and more people die. I felt cold. So we just pretend it's not happening. We contain it. We respond. We document for the people who need to know. And we let everyone else believe in gas leaks and equipment malfunctions and natural causes. His voice softened. This way, life goes on. People go to work, raise their families, and live their lives. They're safe because they don't know they're in danger. Ignorance isn't just bliss here. It's survival. I thought about those residents at Westmont Towers, nodding along as police explained the gas leak, relieved, already moving on with their lives. How long has this been going on? In Chicago? Since before there was a Chicago. Every city has it, has always had it. London, Tokyo, New York, Mexico City. Anywhere where humans gather in large numbers, the things that live in the cracks gather too. And every city has people like us. First responders who see what's really there. And adjusters who make sure no one else has to. The weight of it settled on me. Every call we'd run, every pre-filed report I'd signed, I wasn't just a paramedic anymore. I was part of a massive cover-up. I found Sophie Wu's obituary, I said quietly. Magnus went very still. She worked Type 7s for 12 years, then she retired. Then she died in a car accident 3 months later. I know. Was it really an accident? Magnus was quiet for a long time. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe she just got unlucky. He looked at me. Well, maybe. She started asking too many questions, started digging too deep, started thinking she could do something about it. And they killed her for it? I don't know, he repeated. But I know she's dead, and I know a dozen other paramedics who worked Type 7s and left the job early, and most of them are fine. They're teaching EMT classes, working desk jobs, or retired to Florida. They moved on. They let it go. He sat back down next to me. You're a good paramedic. You stay calm, you think fast, you save lives. That's worth something. That matters. His voice was almost pleading now. Don't throw that away, trying to fight something you can't beat. Just do the job, sign the reports, go home. I looked at my hands. Steady now. But I could still feel the ghost of that dead woman's grip on my wrist. What if I can't let it go? I asked. Magnus closed his eyes. Then you end up like Sophie Wu, one way or another. We sat in silence. Outside, I could hear the day shift arriving, voices in the hallway, someone laughing at a joke I couldn't hear. Normal life, going on like it always did, built on a foundation of lies and cover-ups and things that shouldn't exist. And I was part of it now. The question was, could I live with that? Or would trying to expose it kill me first? A text came 3 days after my conversation with Magnus, unknown number. Meeting tomorrow, 2 p.m, 1515 West Monroe, Suite 800. Come alone. No signature and no explanation. I showed it to Magnus during our shift. He read it, his face going pale. Don't go, he said. What is it? They want to talk to you. The adjusters. He handed my phone back. If you don't go, they'll come to you. If you do go, he trailed off. What? Just be careful what you agree to. 1515 West Monroe was a generic office building in the West Loop. Glass and steel. The kind of place that housed insurance companies and consulting firms. Nothing remarkable. Suite 800 had no name on the door, just the number. I knocked. The door opened immediately. A woman stood there, mid-40s, wearing a charcoal suit. Professional, put together. She smiled like we were old friends. Thank you for coming. I'm Director Reed. She gestured inside. Please. The office was small. A desk, two chairs, no windows. Completely anonymous. She sat behind the desk. I took the chair across from her. You've been doing excellent work, she began. Your reports are thorough. Your discretion is noted. You respond well under pressure. You don't panic, and you understand the importance of protocol. Thank you, I said, because I didn't know what else to say. We'd like to offer you a position. She slid a folder across the desk. Specialized response unit. You'd be responding exclusively to Type 7 calls. Full clearance, significant pay increase. We're talking double your current salary. Better benefits, hazard pay, pension. I opened the folder. The numbers were real. So was the benefits package. this wasn't a token offer. "You'd be part of the whole picture," Reed continued. "No more signing reports you don't understand. You'd be part of the team that handles these situations from start to finish." I looked up at her. "What is the whole picture?" She smiled. "That's what the clearance is for. But understand, this isn't a job you do for a few years then move on. Once you're in, you don't leave. Early retirement isn't an option. You work until we say you're done, and then you transition to a consulting role. You stay in the system. For how long? As long as necessary." She pulled out a tablet, tapped the screen, then turned it toward me. "Let me show you something." The screen displayed a file directory. Names, dates, photographs. I recognized some of them. Paramedics I'd found in my research. Peters, Kleins, Richards, and Sophie Wu. "These are people who tried to walk away," Reed said quietly. "People who worked Type 7 calls, who gained knowledge, who then decided they didn't want to be part of the system anymore." She swiped through the files, each one showing a different outcome. Richards transferred to fire prevention, still alive, still working. Klein, early retirement, moved to Arizona, alive. Peters, training division, alive. Then, Sophie Wu, deceased, car accident. Then some others I didn't recognize, missing persons reports, unsolved deaths, suicides that look suspicious. "We take care of our people," Reed said. "We really do. Good salary, good benefits, protection. You work with us, we make sure you're safe. We make sure your family is safe. We make sure you have a long, comfortable career and a peaceful retirement." She closed the files and looked at me directly. "But only if you stay in line. Only if you follow protocol. Only if you understand that this knowledge comes with responsibility." She paused. "People who try to expose what they've seen, who try to go public, who think they can walk away and live a normal life. They don't understand how deep this goes, how many people are invested in keeping things quiet." "Are you threatening me?" "I'm offering you a choice." She slid the folder closer. "Take the position, join the specialized unit, see the whole picture, make real money, be part of something important. Or stay where you are. Keep running regular calls with Magnus, sign the occasional Type 7 report, and eventually transfer to a nice desk job when you're ready." "And if I don't want either option, if I want out completely?" Reed's smile didn't change, but something shifted in her eyes. "Then you'd be making a mistake, because you already know too much. You've worked multiple Type 7 calls. You've done research. You've found Sophie Wu's obituary." She leaned forward slightly. "You're already in the system. The only question is whether you're an asset or a liability." The room felt small suddenly. "Think about it," Reed said, standing. "You don't have to decide today. But don't take too long. We're starting a new training cycle next month. I'd like you in it." She walked me to the door, handed me a business card. Just a phone number, nothing else. "Call when you're ready. And remember, we're not the enemy. We're the people keeping the city running, keeping people safe. That's worth something." The door closed behind me. I stood in the hallway, staring at the business card. An opportunity, a threat, both at once. I thought about Sophie Wu, about whether her accident was really an accident, about whether I'd have a choice at all if I said no. My phone buzzed. Magnus. How did it go? I didn't know how to answer, because I was starting to realize that the moment I'd signed that first report, the moment I'd walked into apartment 4F, I'd stopped having choices. I was in the system now. The only question was, how deep was I willing to go? I called the number on Rita's card 3 days later. I appreciate the offer, I told her, but I'm going to stay where I am. Silence on the other end. Then, are you sure? This is a significant opportunity. I'm sure. I'm a paramedic. I want to keep doing that job. Another pause. All right. The offer stands if you change your mind. But remember what we discussed. She hung up. Magnus seemed relieved when I told him. Good, he said. Smart choice. Keep your head down. Do the work. Don't ask questions. For a few weeks, everything was normal. Overdoses, chest pain, car accidents, regular calls, no type 7s. Then, on a Wednesday night at 10:48 p.m, Medic 47, Officer Down, Industrial District, Pier 19, Police en route. Officer Down. Marcus's brow furrowed. Officer Down calls don't go through our dispatch. We drove in silence. Pier 19 was in the abandoned industrial district along the river. Empty warehouses, broken windows, and chain-link fences with holes cut through them. No police cars or lights, just a black sedan parked near the warehouse entrance. An adjuster stood beside it, a younger man, expressionless. Inside, he said, second floor. We followed him through the warehouse, our flashlights cut through the darkness, illuminating rusted machinery, broken pallets, graffiti on the walls. The air smelled like mold and rust and something chemical. The second floor was one large open space, empty, except for what was in the center. A perfect circle of salt, maybe 6 feet in diameter. And inside it, a body. A police officer, uniform still visible, lying on his back. But something was wrong. His skin was grey, sunken tight against his bones. His eyes were sunken, his mouth open. He looked mummified, desiccated, like he'd been dead for years. Magnus checked his watch. Call came in 20 minutes ago. I knelt at the edge of the salt circle, not crossing it. No pulse, obviously. The body was completely dried out, like something had sucked every drop of moisture from it. Magnus moved closer, shining his light on the officer's face. Then, he went very still. I know him, he said quietly. Jack Hargrave. He was a beat cop in the 12th District. You knew him? He worked with Sophie Wu. Marcus's voice was tight. They responded to scenes together before she retired. I looked at the adjuster. What happened here? He didn't answer. Magnus stood up, his flashlight sweeping the rest of the warehouse floor. Then he stopped, the beam fixed on something in the darkness. Jeez, he whispered. I followed his light. More circles, dozens of them, scattered across the warehouse floor in no particular pattern. All of them perfect, made of salt, but empty. Magnus turned to the adjuster. He was asking questions, wasn't he? about Sophie, about what really happened to her. The Justice's expression didn't change. "Magnus," I said, "what are these?" "They're for people who know too much." His voice was shaking now. He grabbed my arm. "We need to leave. Now." "We haven't finished the assessment." "There's nothing to assess. He's dead. He's been processed. We need to go." I looked at the empty circles again. Dozens of them. Waiting. "Magnus, now." We walked back through the warehouse, faster this time. The adjuster didn't follow. I could feel his eyes on my back until we reached the exit. Magnus didn't speak until we were in the ambulance, doors locked, engine running. "Those circles," he said, staring straight ahead. "They're not just for containment. They're for disposal. For people. Who become problems." "The adjusters did that?" "I don't know. Maybe. Or maybe they're just cleaning up after something else does it. Either way." He finally looked at me, and I saw the real fear in his eyes. "Jack was a good cop. He and Sophie were close. After she died, he started asking questions, talked to her sister, looked into her accident. And now he's dead in a warehouse full of empty circles." "You think they killed him?" "I think he knew too much and didn't stop asking questions. And they just showed you what happens when you cross that line." He put the ambulance in gear and drove. His hands were shaking on the wheel. I looked back at the warehouse, at the black sedan still parked outside. Somewhere in there, Jack Hargrave's body was being processed, documented, and erased. And dozens of empty salt circles were waiting for the next person who asked too many questions. I thought about the folder in my apartment, the research I'd been doing, the names I'd been tracking. I thought about Rita's offer. "Once you're in, you don't leave." And I thought about those empty circles. Magnus was right. We needed to leave. All I could think was, had I already crossed the line? Or were they just waiting for me to take one more step? My day off. I was at home, halfway through a load of laundry, when my phone buzzed with an emergency page. "Type 7, all available units, respond immediately." The address made my stomach drop. Chicago Memorial Hospital. Our hospital, where we brought patients every shift. I grabbed my keys and drove. The scene was chaos. Police had cordoned off 3 blocks, fire trucks lined the street, at least 6 ambulances were staged in the parking lot, and more were arriving. But no one was going inside. The entire east wing was sealed, plastic sheeting over the doors, adjusters in hazmat suits moving in and out through a decontamination tent. I found Magnus near the ambulance staging area. His face was grey. "What's happening?" I asked. "I don't know. They called everyone in, every paramedic who's worked Type 7s. He looked at the hospital. "Something's wrong, really wrong." An adjuster approached, someone I didn't recognize. "You two, with me." We were led through a decontamination tent, given masks and gloves, then through the sealed doors into the east wing. The hallway was empty. Emergency lighting cast everything in red. The air smelled like ozone and something rotting. We were taken down 2 flights of stairs to the basement level, to the morgue. The doors were propped open. Inside, at least a dozen adjusters were working frantically, setting up equipment, taking readings, speaking urgently into radios. And the bodies were moving. Not all of them, but enough. 5, maybe 6 corpses on gurneys, covered with sheets, that were now sliding off as the bodies beneath them jerked and twitched. Their movements were wrong, spastic and uncoordinated, like puppets with tangled strings. One sat up as I watched, a woman, maybe 60, with a Y incision sutured across her chest. Her eyes were open but filmed over, milky white. Her mouth open and closed, but no sound came out. "My God," Magnus whispered. An adjuster was near us, shouting into a radio. "Containment is failing. Repeat, containment is failing. We need Black Protocol authorization, now." Another corpse rolled off its gurney and hit the floor with a wet thud. It began crawling, dragging itself forward with jerking, mechanical movements toward us. "Stay back," an adjuster warned, pulling us away from the door. But I couldn't look away. The crawling corpse was a man, young, maybe 30, hospital gown hanging off his grey skin. His mouth was moving too, forming shapes, words. I stepped closer, trying to read his lips. "Don't," Magnus started. The corpse's hand shot out and grabbed my ankle. The grip was cold, impossibly strong. I tried to pull away, but couldn't. Its mouth kept moving. And suddenly, I could hear it. Something directly in my head, like a voice made of static. "It's spreading. You can't contain it anymore." An adjuster pulled me back, breaking the corpse's grip. 2 others moved in with some kind of device, pressing it against the body. There was a flash of light, and the corpse went still. But the others were still moving, still jerking and twitching, still mouthing silent words. The doors burst behind us. Director Reed strode in, flanked by 4 more adjusters. She took one look at the scene, and a professional composer cracked for just a second. "How many?" she demanded. 7 animated, more showing early signs. It's accelerating. "Initiate Protocol Black. Clear the building. Everyone out, now." "Director, we haven't contained..." "I said now." She turned to the adjusters around the room. "Full lockdown. No one in or out. We're sealing this entire wing." Magnus grabbed my arm and pulled me toward the exit. We were swept along with a tide of adjusters evacuating the morgue, up the stairs, through the decontamination tent, out into the parking lot. Alarms were blaring now. The entire hospital was being evacuated. Patients, staff, visitors, everyone streaming out of the exits, confused, frightened, and demanding answers. Adjusters were already moving through the crowd with practiced efficiency, herding people away from the East Wing, explaining in calm voices that there had been a gas leak, that it was a precautionary evacuation, that everything was under control. Magnus pulled me away from the crowd, behind one of the ambulances. "This is it," he said, his voice shaking. "Whatever they've been covering up, whatever they've been containing all these years, it's breaking through. It's getting stronger." "What was that down there?" "I don't know, but I know it's never happened before. Did you see their faces? They were panicking. The adjusters were panicking." We watched as more hazmat-suited figures entered the East Wing. Through the windows, I could see flashes of light, hear muffled sounds that might have been screams, or might have been something else. By 4 a.m, the evacuation was complete. The official story was already spreading. Gas leak, no injuries. Hospital would reopen in the morning after safety checks. And by 8 a.m, it did. The East Wing was unsealed, patients were moved back in, staff returned to work, the morgue reopened, like nothing had happened. I was put on mandatory leave the next day. Stress related, they called it. 2 weeks full pay. See the department counsellor before returning to duty. Magnus retired. Just like that, sent an email to the director, turned in his badge and gear, and disappeared. I called him 6 times. He never answered. 3 days into my leave, a package arrived at my apartment. It had no return address, just my name on a plain manila envelope. Inside, a new ID badge, my photo, my name, but a different title. Specialized Response Unit, Level 2 Clearance, and a note typed on plain paper. You don't have a choice anymore. You were there, you saw it. The situation is escalating, and we need experienced personnel. Report Monday, 6 a.m, 1515 West Monroe, Suite 800. Signed, Director Reed. That would have been enough, but there was one more thing in the envelope. A photograph. My sister's house, the one she'd bought in Evanston, her husband's car in the driveway, my nephew's bike on the front lawn. Taken yesterday, based on the date stamp in the corner. There was no direct threat, just the photo. But the implication was clear. I sat on my couch, staring at the ID badge, the note, the photograph. Magnus had been right. Once you're in the system, you don't get out. And I was in deep now, too deep. I'd seen the bodies wake up. I'd heard that voice in my head. It's spreading. You can't contain it anymore. Whatever they'd been covering up for decades, maybe centuries, it was breaking through, getting stronger. And they needed people who'd already seen it, who already knew, to help them fight it, or contain it, or die trying. Monday morning, 6 a.m. I didn't have a choice. I never had. I reported to 1515 West Monroe. The lobby was empty except for a security guard who checked my ID and directed me to the elevator. He pressed the button I hadn't noticed before, one with a symbol I didn't recognize. The elevator went down and down and down. When the doors opened, I wasn't in Chicago anymore. Not the Chicago people knew. The facility was massive. A concrete bunker that stretched in every direction, lit by harsh fluorescent lights. Dozens of people moved through the corridors with purpose. Adjusters, people in hazmat suits, others in tactical gear. The computer stations lined the walls, displaying maps of the city covered in red dots. So many red dots. Director Reed was waiting. "Welcome to operations," she said. "This is where the real work happens." She led me through the facility, showed me labs where people analyzed samples of things I couldn't identify, showed me holding cells with reinforced doors and observation windows that looked into darkness. She showed me an armory stocked with equipment that definitely wasn't standard medical gear. "There are breaches throughout the city," Reed explained as we walked. "Places where reality is thin, where things from the other side can push through. We've been managing them for decades, containing them, cleaning up the aftermath." She stopped in front of a massive display screen showing a map of Chicago. Red dots clustered in certain areas, the industrial district, parts of the south side, and the old subway tunnels. Type 7 calls used to be monthly, then weekly. Now we're getting multiple calls per day. She looked at me. "We're losing ground. Whatever is on the other side, it's pushing through, getting stronger. The incident at the hospital, that was a Category 4 breach. the largest we've ever had in a populated area. What stopped it? We did. Barely. She pulled up footage on a tablet. The hospital morgue, adjusters with devices that pulsed with light, the bodies finally going still. But it cost us. 3 adjusters dead, 2 more in medical, and we had to use Protocol Black, which means we burn through resources we can't easily replace. She handed me a tablet. This is what we're dealing with. This is why we need you. The footage showed other breaches, an apartment where the walls were bleeding, a subway tunnel where the tracks led into somewhere that wasn't Chicago, a park where children's shadows moved independently of their bodies. You've seen it, Reed said. You've been exposed. That makes you valuable. Most people, when they see what's really there, their minds break. They rationalize it away, forget it, or they go insane. But some people, people like you, can see it and stay functional. That's rare. That's necessary. She led me to a locker room where a team was gearing up. 5 people, all around my age, all with the same haunted look I'd seen in Magnus's eyes. Your team, Reed said. They'll train you. You start today. A woman approached, Asian, early 30s, with a scar running down her left cheek. I'm Cho, former paramedic, been with the unit for 2 years. She handed me a vest. Put this on, we've got a call. The vest was heavy, reinforced with something that wasn't just Kevlar. The equipment they gave me looked medical at first glance. Bags, monitors and trauma supplies. But there were other things too. Devices I didn't recognize, containers filled with salt, iron fillings and other substances. A weapon that looked like a cross between a taser and something from a science fiction movie. What is this? I asked. Tools, Cho said. You'll learn what they do. Right now, just stay close and follow my lead. An alarm blared. Red lights flashed. A voice over the intercom. Reality breach, Category 5, Sector 7. Multiple entities, all available units respond. Category 5, worse than the hospital. The team moved with practiced efficiency, loading into an armored vehicle that looked nothing like an ambulance. I climbed in after them. As we pulled out of the facility, through tunnels that led God knows where, Cho handed me a helmet with a visor. Put it on. The visor filters what you see, makes it easier to look at them directly. Look at what? She smiled, but there was no humor in it. You'll see. The vehicle accelerated. I looked at the team around me. They were checking their equipment, loading their weapons, preparing for something I couldn't imagine. I thought about Magnus, about his warning, about Sophie Wu and Jack Hargrave, and all the others who tried to walk away. I thought about my sister's house, that photograph. They were no longer just making me part of the cover-up. They were making me part of the war. Whatever was pushing through those breaches, whatever was making the dead wake up and speak in voices made of static. We were the front line. The people who responded when reality broke, the people who fought to keep it from spreading. The vehicle burst out of the tunnel into the pre-dawn darkness of Chicago. The city looked peaceful from here. Normal. People sleeping in their homes, unaware of what moved in the spaces between. Cho caught my eye. You okay? I adjusted the vest, checked the equipment I didn't know how to use yet. No, I said, honestly. She nodded. Good. Fear keeps you sharp, keeps you alive. The vehicle turned down a side street, heading toward a warehouse district where reality was breaking and things that shouldn't exist were pushing through. And I understood, finally, what Magnus had been trying to tell me all along. You can't walk away from this job, because once you've seen what's really out there, it sees you too, and it doesn't forget. The vehicle stopped, the team moved out, and I followed them into the darkness toward whatever was waiting on the other side of reality. My first call with a new unit, first of many, because here, the calls never stop. And now, neither could I.